On Tech News Today, Microsoft sues the FBI over a gag order and wins. Plus, Google's working on a tablet that can map indoor spaces instantly. And Apple's uncrackable activation lock kill switch feature has been cracked. It's not that hard to do either. All that and more coming up right now.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com. This is Tech News Today for Friday, May 23rd, 2014. This episode is brought to you by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used Apple and Android devices are worth at gazelle.com. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Mike Elgin.
And I'm Jason Howell.
Tech News Today explores the big stories of the day with some of the world's best journalists. Our guest co-anchor today and next week is Natalie Morris, a contributor to NBC and co-founder of ReadQuick, a speed reading app for iOS.
Yes. All of that is true.
Yes.
So, present and accounted for, sir.
Oh, right. Well, Jason wants to know where your Android version is of ReadQuick.
I want to know that, too. It's with our developer.
Uh-huh. We'll, as far as I know. We'll see what we can do with throwing you a wealth of developers, a pile of developers
working
from which you can pick
it.
One and make a version.
TBD.
All right.
It's coming.
Can't wait, Natalie.
When it comes out, you got to tell us first. We want to break the story
all
right
here
on Tech News Today. All right. Well,
but we were, you know, one of the first to the speed reading market for mobile devices, just so you know. Sprint, we were way before them.
All right. Well, for the record, so
you
heard it here first, folks. Well, let's get into the news. The FBI issued a gag order on Microsoft last year, telling the company to keep an FBI request for information about a customer a big secret. So Microsoft took them to court and won. Danny Audrin writes about cybersecurity and hacking for The Wall Street Journal. He's here to tell us all about it. Welcome, Danny.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So can you take us through the sequence of events that led to this ruling? It all started with an FBI request for information.
Exactly. And some of the timeline here is still secret. So we'll work within this. But this seems to have all taken place last year. And, you know, the FBI issued a national security letter, which is the document you use to request national security related information. And it was for a large Microsoft Enterprise customer. And we know this because legal documents show it was an Office 365 customer. So Microsoft pushed back and said, look, you know, go straight to this company and say you want data on one of their employees. Don't have us sort of doing an end around one of our enterprise customers and sort of for understandable reason. But if large companies think Microsoft is handing over their cloud data without telling them straight to the FBI, you know, that's going to cause enterprise clients to think twice about cloud storage, understandably. So Microsoft fought this and, you know, fought the idea that they couldn't tell the customer this. And this all happened right around the same time Edward Snowden started leaking, which just sort of makes this all the more interesting. And then fast forward to yesterday, this comes out. And yes, in a sense, Microsoft did win. You know, the FBI didn't force them to hand over the data. But if you read through the legal documents, you know, the government got what it wanted anyway. It just went to, you know, unnamed company A and got it from them. The other really interesting thing for me with this case is it did shed a little bit of light, on how companies are fighting, government data requests in the age of Snowden and also Microsoft's legal strategy, when it gets these requests. You know, I talked to Brad Smith, their GC yesterday, and he was saying, you know, enterprise and government customers are a particular concern, because the idea is, you know, if they think Microsoft is going over their head, you could see companies abandoning cloud storage.
Right. So one of the interesting things about this, as you mentioned, is that the FBI backed off when Microsoft initially complained, and they said that it was their First Amendment right of free speech that should allow them to tell the customer that they were being investigated. But the FBI went off. They backed off because they or in addition to getting the information directly from the source. But then the FBI kept the gag order in place even if afterwards. And so this is one of the things that it was really interesting and part of this case. And this is really a precedent-setting case, isn't it? Because there's a big question about what cloud providers are required to do. And just as is the case with Microsoft, you know, they really want to protect their customers because the customers are the ones that pay them. And so this is a great precedence for cloud providers, isn't it?
Yes and no. In terms of practice, yes, it definitely, you know, is a precedent that's out in the public. However, the judge who made this ruling made it very clear there is no legal precedent here.
Meaning that the case itself won't set a precedent?
No, I mean, you know, you could certainly see lawyers point back to this and, you know, show that in this instance, you know, the FBI was willing to go straight to the customer. So obviously they're capable of doing that. But at least from the documents released yesterday, you know, there is no indication that the judge turned around and told the FBI, you can't get this from Microsoft. You have to, you know, go get this directly from the customer. By all means, this looks like it was some sort of voluntary agreement.
This may be a question for This Week in Law. Maybe they can bring this up there, because how can you just say, I'm going to make this okay this time, but there is no precedent, so no one else from here on out use this?
Exactly. And, you know, you'll certainly, I would assume, cloud providers will bring this case up going forward now that it is public. But at the same time, you know, lawyers can't point to a specific legal document from a judge saying, you know, in the case of cloud providers, you have to go to the client itself. You know, it's perfectly foreseeable where the FBI in a future case would be more adamant that Microsoft would have to hand this over, and it could be a more protracted legal battle.
So how do we establish these rules for what law enforcement can and can't do? And also, would those rules be different for surveillance-based requests, like from the NSA for national security reasons rather than, you know, police type activity? How do we establish these rules?
Well, I mean, this is something that's all worked out through national security courts. And the other thing to be clear here is that oftentimes, you know, when the NSA, the past year we've been talking about, you know, the types of data the NSA collects, that is done through the FBI. For the NSA. But, you know, generally you don't get a letter, you know, from Fort Meade in Maryland saying, you know, the National Security Agency would like this data. It is from the FBI. In this particular case, it is not bulk collection. You know, the FBI was going after a very specific target. And in terms of setting a precedent, I mean, what you need to see is if you want to see a precedent set, you're going to see tech companies, you know, keep bringing up these cases, and maybe there will be rulings going forward. The problem is then they're often under seal and you and I don't hear about them.
Yeah. All right. Well,
what about this as a public relations move? Because Microsoft seems very proud of this victory, so it makes them look like they are for the consumer, or at the very least for their customers. But you don't want to be known as a troublemaker either. Like when the government asks you for something, you're going to push back automatically. So, you know, where do they balance that? How do they want to be known for this?
I think in the current climate we're in right now, there is no downside to being a troublemaker if you're a tech company, at least from a public relations perspective. You know, Microsoft, Google, Facebook, these companies all right now are really trying to push back on this type of data collection, at least publicly, to at least have that posture. And I think that's why you saw Microsoft trumpeting this yesterday. It's because, you know, it's a rare instance where, you know, there's a lot of these cases, but this particular one was unsealed. And so Microsoft has a chance to hold up a document from a federal court, which, you know, doesn't happen often.
Right. So the government just doesn't have a big stick anymore. It's their big digital stick now has so much transparency that they can't just do what they want.
I mean, I don't know if we're quite at that point yet, but I mean, with the larger tech companies, when we're talking about the Microsofts, the Googles, the Facebooks, I think, you know, they're willing to be as loud as possible, you know, without being held in contempt of court, such as Lavabit, Edward Snowden's email provider, was last summer. And you know, that is certainly, you know, a tool the government still has that I don't think you want to see, that big tech companies are quite yet willing to provoke, where, you know, you're actually disobeying a, you know, federal judge.
Well, Danny Yodgren, okay. I want to thank you for coming on Tech News today and explaining the story.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, guys. Really enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it, too. Well, you can find Danny Yodgren's work at WSJ.com, of course. And you can find him on Twitter at Danny Yodgren, Yadron. Well, in a sec, we're going to tell you about new research going on at Google. First, I want to tell you about Gazelle. Gazelle wants to buy your used gadgets. And the reason they want to do that is because they're going to put it back into circulation. Somebody can use that device that's sitting around in your drawer, in a box, in the garage, under the bed, in the doghouse, wherever your gadgets are stored. You know you've got some lying around, and they're worth real money and probably more money than you think. Just go to Gazelle's website, G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com, find your device, tell the condition, and then they'll give you a price. That price is locked in for 30 days. So even if the value of that device goes down over the next 30 days, they'll honor the price. That's why you want to go in right now to gazelle.com and find out how much your devices are worth. You'll get a box in the mail. It'll be self-addressed. All you have to do is put the sticker on the outside of the box and give it back to your mail person. And then, you know, off it goes, and they'll pay you fast by check, PayPal, or the best option, in my opinion, is the Amazon gift card option, because they'll give you 5% more money for your device. It's risk-free. And again, offers are good for 30 days, and they'll wipe your data. So if you have some personal data in there somewhere and you're not sure exactly if you've really deleted it all, they'll take care of it for you to make sure that your personal information is protected. Gazelle has paid more than $100 million to over 700,000 customers. Shipping is free and easy. There are no listing hassles at all. So go to gazelle.com right now and find out what your Apple or Android devices are worth. Take a minute. Go to gazelle.com to find out. Do it now, because your devices may lose value the longer you wait. We've reported in the past on Google's Project Tango, which is an experimental smartphone that can quickly and accurately map indoor spaces and objects. It's great for things like games and all kinds of things. Last night, the Wall Street Journal reported that Google's also making a Tango tablet. Rolf Winkler is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal and one of the two journalists who broke this story. Welcome, Rolf.
How you doing, Mike?
I'm doing great. Thank you. Before we talk about the tablet, can you tell us about Project Tango generally?
Sure. Project Tango was launched earlier this year. We saw a smartphone that they are releasing to developers, which basically it's packed with cameras, with sensors, and they have a great video that you can see on YouTube that shows how you carry it. You got it right there on your screen. Where you can carry this phone around, and it does a great job of mapping your surroundings. And you can think of applications like better indoor navigation for the visually impaired. You can think of potentially very immersive video games. There's potentially a lot of things you can do with technology like this.
So what did your sources tell you about the tablet itself?
We have some basic idea of what it's going to be. It's going to be seven. First of all, we found out that there is going to be another device, a seven inch screen. It's going to have two back cameras, infrared depth sensors, software to capture 3D images precisely. It's somewhat akin to what we've heard about the smartphone coming from Project Tango that we have already seen in those videos.
Is it going to be identical, just larger, or are there going to be subtle differences, do you think?
Hard to say. I mean, we have those basic details that I just shared with you, but we don't know precisely what it looks like. We don't know precisely when it's going to come, though it could be soon. It could be sooner than we think, and potentially ahead of Google I.O., which is their developer conference at the end of next month.
And can you flesh out a little more of the consumer application of this beyond just sort of special needs? Last year for CNBC, I did a story about indoor mapping for retailers. And there's a lot of money to be made if someone gets that right. But it's really kludgy right now. Different shopping centers have their own devices. And so is there a retail component of this, or what are the other consumer applications?
Natalie, you ask the key question, which sort of gets to the distribution of this device, which is, what are those applications going to be? We don't really know. This is really new technology, and that's why Google is only making 4,000 of them, which they're going to give to developers, like with the original Project Tango smartphone, also that is being released in limited quantities to developers. The idea, of course, is have those developers come up with applications to make these devices useful. This is sort of a very interesting to see how Google likes to release its new gadgets versus someone like Apple, right? Look at Google Glass. This is a device that was launched or was unveiled in 2012, and only just a couple weeks ago was made available to anyone who wanted to buy it. It's been something that developers have been playing with, early testers, for a long time. Google likes to dog food these things. That's the verb for it. They like to dog food it in public, let people figure it out. And that has pluses and minuses. And one of the big pluses is you get a company like Quest Visual that Google just bought, which came up with this really ingenious app that you know, for Google Glass, where if you look at a sign in a different language, it can translate it automatically for you, augmented reality, right on your screen. It's brilliant. And it's the kind of thing that, you know, you put Google Glass out there, people come up with interesting ideas for it, and maybe a device that would seem very weird and unnatural can start to have applications that make them useful. I think you're going to get something. Wow, I'm very impressed with your guys. You found that fast. Look at that. That's WordLens right there. That's what you're seeing on a smartphone. But imagine that on Google Glass. Google just bought this company that does something just like this. Anyway, imagine that for something like Project Tango. There's going to be applications that we really can't think of right now because, you know, that's why I'm a journalist. I'm not a developer.
Right, but useful and profitable are two very different things, and that's a great way to differentiate Apple and Google, is that Google just tries stuff. Maybe it'll be profitable. Apple won't do anything until it thinks it's profitable. So, but some, you know, I've seen some kind of fun applications of this kind of indoor mapping technology. For instance, there's a grocery store, I forget the name of the chain, that has indoor maps that you can download on your smartphone. And then when you say, okay, where are the macaroni? It'll tell you which aisle. And then when you get there, give you a coupon. And, you know, that actually is a way to become profitable with this kind of stuff. But to just hold your smartphone up so that you know which sign says the men's room so you don't walk into the wrong bathroom, how are you going to make money on that? Right.
Well, that's a good thought too, Natalie, because if something like that were to happen, let's think forward a little bit and imagine that grocery stores decide, you know what, I'm going to upload my inventory information, where items are sitting on my shelves, and we're going to create an application that provides all that information. That's data, right? That could lead to purchases. And the more of that, sort of thinking out loud right here with you, I don't know how Google would necessarily get that information into its servers, but it would maybe provide a lot of this as a service.
In the same way they do with maps.
And if it got that data, that is incredibly valuable and very profitable in the long run.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Rolf Winkler, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News today and telling us about the Tango tablet.
Thank you, Mike.
It's a great story, and you can find stories like this from Rolf Winkler at WSJ.com. You can find Rolf Winkler at Rolf Winkler on Twitter. Well, Apple's uncrackable kill switch called Activation Lock has been cracked. Joining us now is Alex Heath, who wrote about the exploit on the Cult of Mac website. Welcome, Alex.
Hey, Mike.
Before we talk about the hack, can you explain what Activation Lock is exactly?
Sure. Activation Lock is Apple's anti-theft deterrent system that they introduced in iOS 7. And it's designed so that, say, a phone is stolen, the thief tries to restore it in iTunes, and as he's setting it up as a new device, it requires the original owner's login information, so their Apple ID and their password. So basically what you have is a bricked iPhone that can't be used. And smartphone theft is rampant, and it accounts for about half of the crimes in cities like San Francisco and New York City. So it's something that lawmakers have been pressing companies like Apple to do in their smartphones.
And the lion's share of those thefts are Apple devices. They're easy to identify because they tend to have white earbuds poking out there. So what is the name of this exploit, and how does it work?
Sure. It's called Dolce, which is iCloud backwards, and it's this pair of anonymous hackers that put the website up for it this week, and they're claiming to have the world's first iCloud activation bypass. And so essentially they perform a man-in-the-middle attack where they claim that it's for people who have just lost their iPhones. They're not claiming to support thievery, but obviously this is what something like this would be used for. When you're restoring the phone, they trick it into thinking that it's talking to Apple servers and being activated when it's actually talking to theirs. And it's a relatively easy process that really only requires a single line of code being added to the host file on a Mac or PC or even Linux machine. Anybody can do it. And there's been people on Twitter sharing photos from the Philippines and China of dozens of iPhones that have been unlocked using this hack. And I have a hard time believing that it's all for personal use.
Yeah, that's a good point. Now, this requires actual servers that are maintained by the hackers. Have these servers been shut down? Or are they still operating?
No, they're still operational. And as of a couple days ago, they had seen over 30,000 unlocks through them in just one day. And I've tried to contact Apple about this, and they're not issuing any comments on it yet. But the hackers have told me that they've been in communication with Apple, but I don't think anything's come of that yet.
Now, you mentioned this SIM card problem at the end. It says that once you use this exploit, the SIM card won't be recognized. So you could never use it as a phone again. Essentially, it becomes an iPod Touch, right?
Right. And that's actually something that they're saying they have a workaround for and they're going to introduce soon. But yeah, that issue is because they can trick iOS into thinking it's activated, but they haven't been able to trick the baseband, which is the part of the phone that communicates with the carrier, into thinking that it's active. And they're claiming that they actually have a fix for this. But for iPads or iPod Touches that are stolen or misplaced, it would work like normal. But with the phone, yes, you still have that SIM blocking issue.
Now, Alex Heath, do they kind of have a point? Is activation lock a problem? I mean, for example, you can imagine a scenario where somebody has an old device, they don't remember what their password is or something like that, and they could end up with being locked out of their own device. Is this a legitimate problem that requires some solution other than an exploit? Is this something that Apple should deal with better?
You know, I'm not really sure, to be honest. I've tried to think of scenarios where this would be useful to somebody that's just genuinely lost their phone or misplaced it. But the thing is, if you have your login information, you can access where the device is. You can even remotely wipe it from iCloud.com. So I guess in a scenario where you've forgotten your Apple ID, maybe. But I really don't see many practical applications for this beyond thievery.
And that kind of person, this is too hard for them. That kind of person is going to march themselves up to the genius bar. They're not going to put this hack on their phone.
Right. And you just have to look at, that these hackers have been retweeting people that have used their hack. And you just look at where it's coming from. It's all coming from third world countries, emerging markets, South America, the Philippines, South Korea, stuff like this, where the black market for iPhone sales, people will steal them in the U.S. and then ship them overseas and sell them at a premium. And that's where something like this really comes into play, because you don't have a brick device anymore, which is what Apple intended for activation lock to do.
Right. It's not like, oh, poor Aunt Mildred, she forgot her password again. Time to, put this Dolce server on. Go ahead, Aunt Mildred.
Right. The real issue here is that, this was Apple's big stake in the ground for a kill switch in their devices. And the fact that it can be so easily intercepted with such a simple man-in-the-middle attack where they literally just reroute traffic is kind of concerning. And so I'm hoping that Apple will comment on this soon. I've spoken with security researchers who say that if Apple were to push an iOS update, they could potentially patch it. But the hackers I've spoken to have also said that they have other workarounds in their back pocket in case they need to pull them out.
And this all takes place in the context of states throughout the U.S. passing laws that require activation lock like kill switches.
Right.
And that includes the state of California, which once California has such a law, it's basically national because 1 in 8 Americans lives in California. And the cell phone companies are just going to change all their policies. So, Alex Heath, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News Today.
Thanks for having me.
All right. You can find Alex Heath at cultofmac.com. And also on Twitter at Alex E. Heath. Google is close to announcing the acquisition of Skybox Imaging, according to an exclusive by Ingrid London at TechCrunch. Skybox Imaging captures very high-resolution photos and videos of the Earth from orbiting satellites, and the purchase would give Google a space program. Natalie Morris, this is a cool thing. I love how aggressive Google is at improving the services around mapping and satellites. Here they are. They're going to buy a company that deals in rockets and satellites. How cool is that?
Well, right. But what's so interesting about this is the international tensions that really affect this, because they want to send up satellites through, let's see, what is the name of this? The Soyuz vehicle, which is scheduled to go out of Kazakhstan, which is controlled by Russia, which we don't get along with right now. So they're going to have to come up with some kind of workaround. But they're being very bullish on this kind of thing. They want image indoor, they want images outdoor, they want satellite images. And what I wasn't aware of was how competitive this space is. If they don't buy Skybox, there are a lot of other companies that do similar things that they could be interested in.
Absolutely. And this has been rumored for weeks. Ingrid London had three sources on this. And the price is estimated at $1 billion, which is essentially lunch money for Google. And, you know, this will be useful for Google Maps and Google Earth, but also Google has a business division called Earth Enterprise, which enables companies to store their own, you know, terabytes of data with satellite imagery, terrain, vector data, and other sorts of things. So there are lots of places where Google could use this. I believe that we're going to get to the point where the kinds of maps and things that we see on Google Earth and Google Maps, the satellite photos, are going to be either real-time or close to real-time or updated daily or, you know, reflecting the current weather or something like that in some kind of real-time capacity. And I think that's what Google is trying to get to, this idea that you look at Google Maps and the maps you're looking at are, you know, 6 months old or something like that, is something that Google believes that they can just, you know, change by purchasing companies like this. And I think this is just the beginning of the kind of satellite imagery companies that Google intends to purchase. So it's pretty
right. We're so used to now having information about our surroundings at all times. I was just talking to my husband about this. If I'm on a flight that doesn't have a map of where we are in that flight, I don't like it. I feel handicapped. I feel like I'm used to that information now. And the Malaysian Airlines flight that went down is perfect example of how used to we are of having information and streaming video of all around us. So this one company that's talked about in the TechCrunch post called Earthcast, it's spelled with a U-U-R-T-H-E-cast, is trying to create streaming video from satellite imagery of the entire Earth, which is so amazing to think about. Where do you put that data and do you save it and on what servers? But clearly, you know, there's a use for that. I would like to see that kind of thing.
Absolutely. Well, TNT fan Kyle Viach posted a great idea for Netflix in our tech news today, Google Plus community. He writes that in reference to yesterday's conversation about Netflix peer-to-peer, here's an idea. Why can't Netflix build P2P connections into your favorites list? Videos that have been recently added or even marked as favorite can be downloaded during off-peak times when you're not watching and then peered to others nearby during peak times to ease congestion. I'm sure it wouldn't be hard for Netflix to decide which shows to peer, the ones that are trending, shows like House of Cards or Orange is the New Black, or maybe they should launch a new show called, you know, Peer-to-Peer is the New Peering or something like that. This is a great idea. And of course, they've talked about different types of peer-to-peer scenarios, and it only makes sense. It doesn't make sense to download a single file each time somebody wants to watch a movie when you can sort of do what BitTorrent and other clients have done. I just think this makes a whole lot of sense. Natalie, do you think there would be cultural or legal or other reasons why this wouldn't be a good idea?
I don't know. I'm just wrapping my head around it. It is such a great idea, like a piggyback network. It seems almost too practical to work.
Yeah, right. It's too good of an idea.
The government will come up with some reason that exactly. They don't want it.
Exactly. Well, the background is that storage is so cheap. You could have terabytes and terabytes and terabytes of storage. And, of course, Sony makes devices for 4K movies. They even sell a device that comes with movies already installed on it that's very large capacity. But why not? Why not have a gigantic storage capacity near your TV and just download movies just in case you want to see it? And eventually they can offload them. They can use algorithms to figure out what you like, what you're likely to watch, and so on. It's completely doable. And I think it makes a lot of sense to do that because, nowadays it just doesn't make sense to wait for a long period of time to watch a movie or to be restricted to low-quality movies because of bandwidth constraints and that sort of thing. So
I think I don't know enough about licensing. For instance, if my kids are always streaming Avengers, Earth Mightiest Heroes from Netflix. So, you know, does Netflix have to pay a licensing fee for every time we stream that? Or is there just some lump sum? Because if that's the case, then when I start caching these episodes, will Netflix have to pay for that even if I don't use him?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good question. And hopefully these answers will come and we'll see what Netflix does in this space. They're really the company to do it because they gobble up so much bandwidth on the internet, a huge percentage every single day. Well, Samsung is working on a smartwatch smartphone. Yeah, instead of connecting via Bluetooth to a real smartphone, the watch itself is a phone, like Dick Tracy or something. The company's currently talking with carriers in the United States, Europe, and South Korea about supporting the watch. And the watch reportedly takes pictures, sends email, and has its own built-in GPS electronics. It even has a heart monitor. The Wall Street Journal reported the story this morning based on unnamed sources, but the report appears to solidify news in April that Samsung had patented an integrated smartwatch called the Gear Solo, It sounds like a likely name that something like Samsung would actually name a product like this. But the rumors or the news back in April said that they were only going to launch it in Korea. The Wall Street Journal report says, no, they're talking to carriers in Europe and the United States as well. And that's great news. Korea really shouldn't be greedy and selfish with its technology. Share it with all of us. We love it. I'm not sure that this is ultimately a great idea because I think, Natalie Morris, most people want to carry a smartphone anyway. So you might as well use the smartphone to provide the internet connection and some of the processing power and electronics and, you know, sort of make the watch as small as possible. I think building a phone into a watch makes it unnecessarily large.
I just don't know how you're going to do that. It seems so ridiculous.
Yeah.
But, I don't. Go ahead.
From a battery perspective, how do you do that and live up to the expectations of the consumer, right? If suddenly they're leaving their smartphone at home because their watch is the smartphone, well, take a look at the batteries that are required inside of your smartphone to power it, let alone some little thing that people want small, but they want functional, and they're never going to have both of those, not with the current battery technology.
Maybe it comes with a backpack that has a Tesla battery.
Yeah, exactly.
On it like that.
If you're wearing a backpack to power your watch, then there's something. Yeah. Samsung, sorry.
Or maybe it's powered by the pedometer that's already inside it. So you have to walk in circles to get it. Hang on. I got to keep walking while I'm talking to you. And how many times? A lot of times I'll check something on my phone and I'm like, I just don't feel like using this tiny keyboard. I'll respond to this later. Like, can you imagine me pecking something out on my. I mean, I guess it'll use voice activation. But even that is not
similar
foolproof.
Similar to like glass or something.
Yeah.
It's possible, you know, it's possible to use voice activation for these things and have it work pretty well. Glass proves that, but it's not perfect. Definitely not perfect.
Seems so silly.
Yeah, it does seem silly, but here's one viable use case. It could be used for fitness. You want to go running, you want to do a marathon or something like that. You want a phone with you, but you don't want to carry your phablet while you're running. I mean, where do you put it? So, you know, this essentially frees you up to have a phone with you and it enables you to have a gigantic phone that's too big to really carry when you're at the gym or you're, you know, jogging or doing whatever, you know, sailing, whatever it is you're doing that, you know, wear a
phone. Oh, this is the first world problem.
Oh, it's the first world is the problem.
You need your cell phone while you're sailing.
Yes, absolutely. Think of the poor sailors, what they go through. It's awful. Well,
those triathletes really need to be in touch with us.
That's right, exactly. Well, that's the tech news today. Natalie Morris, I want to thank you for guest co-anchoring today. And I'm looking forward to next week because you're going to be the guest co-anchor all week.
I'll be here all the week. Yes, we'll be off Monday, though, people. We're taking the holiday to memorialize.
We absolutely will, and we shall remember. Hopefully I'll remember not to come to work. Well, you can subscribe to Tech News Today at twit.tv/TNT. We want to hear from you. So comment on Twitter or Google+ using the hashtag Tech News Today, and that's how we'll find it. Send us an email at tnt@twit.tv or leave us voicemail by calling 260-TNT-SHOW. Also, don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight at 4 p.m. Pacific. Jason, are you on tonight?
I am.
All right.
I'll be there.
That's Jason tonight, Sarah Lane, the rest of the week, next week. So, you know, make sure you tune in and watch that every weeknight at 4 p.m. Pacific. I'm Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. As Natalie said, we're off on Monday for the holidays, so we see you back here on Tuesday. Take care.